The next faculty member I interviewed for this program is Dr. Lee Schwartzberg, who's been a champion of oncology research conducted in a community setting. I met with Lee, who specializes in breast cancer, to learn more about his innovative and important work. He began our discussion by commenting on a fascinating electronic tool he's developed to gather information from patients.
It came out of some work we were doing on pain assessment initially, and we put together a project on doing a better job in symptom assessment, initially using paper and pencil tools and engaging the whole clinic to do a better job taking care of patients with pain. Because as you know, the oncologist is usually the last person to hear about the patient's symptoms, and they're much more likely to talk to the nurse or sometimes the phlebotomist or even the front desk person about what's really bothering them. Patients a lot of times don't want to get bad news or offend their doctors, and there's this interesting dynamic between patients and physicians that sometimes they don't even want to talk about their most important symptom because it might be a harbinger that they're not doing as well. So they tend to keep things from the doctor, or in the course of a busy 10-minute interview with a patient, you may not have time to hit all the high points. So we started with pain, and we found that there was really a great place for improvement with pain. And then we thought, how can we use technology to improve this? Because we're in the era now where it's archaic to take data down on paper and pencil. This was a little bit before the advent of EMRs being used from the focus of the professional. So we went through a number of iterations of technology. We came up with a tablet-based computer. And Barry Fortner, who's a psychologist working with us, developed a series of symptom scales called the Patient Care Monitor. And basically, it's evolved into a complete review of systems. So version 2, each version has been validated. We tested it against a normative database. We tested it eventually against an expert nurse interview of all of these symptoms with the patient, which often took an hour and a half. And basically what we've refined it down to is that every time the patient comes into the office, they're handed the tablet. They can identify themselves through the tablet, and so it's all HIPAA compliant. And using a touchscreen computer, they basically answer these questions about their review systems.
How long does it take usually?
It takes about 10 minutes to answer through all the questions because it's automated. It's very quick. It takes about 5 or 10 minutes for someone to show the patient how to do it the first time. We've tested it in elderly patients. We have a Spanish version that's available for Spanish-speaking individuals. We put it in Duke University about 18 months ago, and Amy Abernathy in the breast clinic there has been using it. She actually had some posters at ASCO, which was a survey of the usage of an independent survey in the Duke Breast Cancer Clinic, and it was very favorably reviewed there.
Now, how does the doc get the data? Do you read it off the tablet or it gets transferred into some other system?
So basically, we utilize the time that the patient is waiting for the doc. So they're handed it as soon as they walk in. Usually, we keep them in a bookshelf charger by the front desk. They're handed by the front desk person. They're very easy to use, and they fill out the information. As soon as they finish the survey, it's electronically ported to the server in the practice compared to the normative database and to the patient's previous determinations and is then printed at the pod that the physician is seeing the patient. Or if the patient's coming for chemotherapy, there's actually a shorter list of questions. So we can vary the questions. We can put up any survey we want. But the core PCM, patient care monitor, is a review of systems, and it serves a lot of purposes. First of all, it serves a billing purpose and a documentation purpose. It meets the need for a level 5 billing event for a visit because it's a full review of systems. More importantly, it really shapes the interview with the patient. So when I'm handed this, I can see instantly it's a 0 to 10 Likert scale, so it's all printed out there. Their last two determinations are out there and their baseline. So I can scan across and see that all of a sudden the patient has dyspnea, which they never had before, or it's been getting gradually worse. We've tracked it in adjuvant breast cancer, and it's very interesting to see how patients report their self-reporting, for example, of alopecia peaks after the first or second cycle, but then they don't report it so much anymore, and it goes away. And you can track neuropathy very carefully. You can track mucositis through it. You can track any symptom through it. So it serves the purpose for helping the patient and the doctor to refine the interview on what the real issues are. And it also serves a research purpose as well.
To what extent is this type of approach being used outside of oncology and in other parts of oncology?
We have adapted this system for use in cardiology as well, and it's been piloted in cardiology. We developed it initially with an oncology focus because a lot of it's around treatment side effects. In fact, one of the original scales, it was validated on the scale level rather than the item level, was treatment side effect scales. But it also can be adapted to any, really any internist or any branch of medicine, because it includes essentially a complete review of systems and functional items and psychiatric items. And you know, Neil, one thing that doctors do very poorly, at least I'll speak for myself, is we don't take good psychiatric histories, we don't take good sexual histories, we don't take good sleep histories. And the two most highest rated items that we see, not only for patients getting chemotherapy, but after chemotherapy, as we're following them and assume the role of being their primary care physician in many respects after adjuvant therapy, is that those symptoms are reported very frequently. It may have to do with the fact that we're not comfortable in dealing with them. We're not comfortable in talking to them, and we may not have good ways of addressing them. But they're there, and just ignoring them is not the right way either.
How long have you yourself been using the system?
So we've been working with it since we developed it and through multiple iterations, so about 6 or 7 years. And I find it indispensable now. If it ever goes down and I don't have it, it's like not having the CBC. And literally, I walk in with the chart, the CBC, and the PCM. So it's very quick for me to get right to the heart of what's going on with the patient.
What's it cost the doc to buy this system or use the system?
The current model is there is no cost to the doc. We've basically supplied them through projects that have been data reporting. So we've had third-party payers who have been gathering data about patients through this. We're now moving to a revenue-sharing kind of model as those projects end.
So for an oncologist in practice who wants to try this out, what's involved?
Really just contacting us. We have 100 practices now and 500 doctors around the country that are using it. And that translates into about 500,000 patients on the system right now and about 40,000 new patients expected in 2007. Now, the other part of what the data is you can use it, first of all, in your practice for your individual patient, but also correlate across your practice. And then we extract the data HIPAA compliant without the patient identifiers. So we can do retrospective symptom assessment studies, which have become very powerful because we have this huge database. So we've looked at, for example, symptom patterns in different diseases. In breast cancer, we looked at what happened with AIs versus tamoxifen in terms of the symptoms. Sometimes we have to go back and link to the chart to get other clinical data because this is just symptom data. But we're now linking EMRs to the PCM, to our central database.
That's interesting. What did you see with the AIs and tamoxifen?
What we saw was that the incidence of myalgias and arthralgias were the most common reported event, as you'd expect with AIs, with vasomotor symptoms being number one with tamoxifen. We saw about 20% of patients who were on AIs having a switch from their initial AI to another agent, most commonly a second AI. Although a few to tamoxifen.
And you actually reported that.
And we've reported that, yeah.
I thought that was really interesting because, you know, in terms of how AIs are actually playing out in practice, were you able to determine what fraction of patients end up having to go off AIs completely?
It was a small fraction, actually. It was only about 5% of patients who went off an AI and or couldn't tolerate an AI at all or tamoxifen.
Fascinating. One thing I'm curious whether you've looked at, I think I mentioned to you we did this recent Patterns of Care survey where we saw 30% of docs in the U.S. who were prescribing nab-paclitaxel use pre-medications with it, sort of counterintuitive since one of the advantages was not using pre-medications.
Right.
And I'm curious whether or not you've been able to detect the corticosteroid impact on pre-medications with using this instrument.
That's a great thought. We haven't actually looked at that specifically, but that would be very easy to do. Now, we'd have to track that with the actual usage of the chemotherapy,
right,
which
sure.
We can do through billing information if we don't have an EMR linked.
What do you think you'd see?
I think we'd see that there are profound influences of corticosteroids on patient symptoms and behavior. Acute symptoms of insomnia and jitteriness, anxiety, agitation, chronically, of course, diabetes and the attendant problems with that, perhaps some increase in infections and swelling and so forth.
What are your thoughts about what we found, incidentally, in terms of the fact that some people are still using pre-medication?
I think it's sobering, and I think it reflects a lack of information getting through, and I think it reflects the fact that oncologists today, first of all, wear many hats and are barraged with information. The problem we have today is not getting access to all the new data that's out there. It's making sense of it and filtering it. And for busy practitioners, they're there taking care of patients. It's been made easy, partly through some of your efforts to get the information, but not everybody gets to all the information and has it made sense for them. So this is one of those things that I think you've identified. There's no good reason, and I would really doubt that it's being given other than the inertia of having treated patients with other taxanes and using corticosteroids with them.
I mean, it wasn't used in the trials.
Right.
Any rationale from the point of view of nausea and vomiting?
I don't think so. I think that in my experience using nab-paclitaxel, the incidence of nausea and vomiting is very low. And I think that per NCCN and ASCO guidelines, there really wouldn't be any reason to use it routinely. Now, there's an occasional patient that either has a hypersensitivity reaction or does have nausea and vomiting with taxanes. And certainly the lowest level of first line of antiemetic prophylaxis would be steroids alone or an HT3 receptor antagonist alone. But certainly many people would use corticosteroids in that setting.
What is your take on nab-paclitaxel and how, or if at all, are you using it in your practice?
I'm using it frequently in the metastatic setting, rarely in the adjuvant setting, and that's driven mainly by reimbursement issues. I'm intrigued about using it in the adjuvant setting. I think in terms of its efficacy, it's at least as good, if not better, than solvent-based paclitaxel based on the fact that one can deliver higher doses perhaps at least, although there's theoretical reasons that while the nab-paclitaxel might actually have better tumor entry and might be more effective even on a milligram per milligram basis, that remains to be proven because there are no trials to address that now. Nonetheless, the phase 3 trial that has been completed and the randomized phase 2 study suggests that at least response rates are greater with nab-paclitaxel than solvent-based paclitaxel. At the very least, it's easier and more convenient to give. It's actually less resource burdensome to the practice as well because of less chair time, less time for the patient in the clinic, and less nursing time as well.
Can you talk a little bit about the clinical research that's going on within ACORN?
Sure. ACORN stands for Accelerated Community Oncology Research Network. It's a network we started about 4 years ago. And basically, it was an offshoot of SOS, but it was based on the fact that I've been involved with research in the community setting my whole career, and been involved in other networks in the past, and felt that there was a real need to try to find a different way to do things, because clearly the rate of patients going on clinical trials in the U.S. is, to my mind, unacceptable when only 2 or 3% of patients get on a clinical trial. And I feel that we're in such an unusual situation now. I think we have this explosion of understanding of the biology of cancer. We're starting to understand where the targets are. We haven't always created a reagent to those targets, but I think we're starting to have a pretty good idea of where we need to go. And yet, the final common pathway and the blockade is going to be doing the clinical studies. Time and again, we see that the theories don't always pan out or we get unusual results in the clinic. So while models and genomics and supercomputing and analyses are very helpful, to my mind, at least in my career, they're not going to replace good old-fashioned clinical trials and to test them in patients because obviously there are other factors involved. Now, the issue is that with all these new agents and the fact that many of them are used in combination, where are the patients going to come from to test them in? And we know where they're coming from now. They're actually coming from the rest of the world. There's something of a giant sucking sound, which is clinical research going outside the United States. And that's not something that any of the companies or I think physicians or thought leaders or leaders in the oncology community in the United States necessarily want to happen. We certainly welcome the collegial cooperation with the rest of the world, but we want to get the studies done here. We want our patients to get access to these drugs early. So we need a new model. What we thought was it's very difficult to do oncology research in a community practice because they're not set up the way academic centers used to be set up, although increasingly I think we're meeting in the middle. Academic centers are seeing a lot more patients than they used to. The old model of one protocol, one research nurse, one patient, where you follow the patient through, simply doesn't work anymore. And we need a new model. So we took two approaches. One was, how can we redesign research so it fits the practice? And number two, how can we use technology like we did in SOS to facilitate the process? So we joined with practices that were interested in the problem, not just in putting patients on study, but were interested in making research part of their practice. And we've worked through it. I wouldn't say that we have the answers by any means, but part of the answer is focusing the research effort in the practice on the people that really need to be there, which are the research coordinators and the doctors. It's so inefficient. What used to happen in my practice at the West Clinic, which was the research nurse would meet the patient at the front desk, would take them around to phlebotomy, sometimes draw their blood themselves, would go through the chemotherapy, whatever the study protocol was with the patient, pack up the lab kit themselves, and do all the paperwork. This is the most experienced person in your practice. They don't have to do that, and that uses an enormous amount of their time. So making research a fundamental part of the way we take care of patients, which is what we've done in the West Clinic, so everyone in the practice is invested. The research is not a little standalone that's hard and it's different and it's uncomfortable for patients, but to engage the practice in it was part of it. The other part was technology, and what we decided was actually, almost everything about doing research in oncology is very different than the way we take care of practice. We treat the patients according to a very specific protocol. We have to watch them carefully. We have to analyze them for adverse events and so forth. That can be done. But the things like regulatory, things like contracting and billing, even data management are not part of the standard practice of oncology. So what ACORN did, and I think this is something we did that is unique to our practice. Centralization is certainly not, and there are several other networks out there that have done a good job at that. But what we did that was somewhat unique was we developed a suite of technology tools that allowed everything to be done at ACORN, particularly the data management. We started doing that with an electronic scanning system, which gives a certified copy of the chart so that the actual chart exists at the site. But now we have an electronic certified copy, and we've been able to sort that copy and allow monitoring at ACORN. That doesn't completely abrogate the need for monitoring on site, of course. You need to meet the PI. You need to do drug accountability. You need to make sure the patients are there. But it actually makes things efficient. So our belief is it makes things more efficient for the sites, and West Clinic is a good proof of principle because we were able to 250% increase in accruals with reducing our staff by two-thirds. So I have 8 full-time employees now doing research at the West Clinic, and those are coordinators, a director, and 2 assistants. Everything else is done at ACORN, including regulatory and all of that other piece.
What does the, I guess, revenue variations that are available for participation in trials, industry trials, NCI-based trials, obviously it varies based on the type of trials, but broadly, what kind of reimbursement is available and how does that match up with what the costs are? I hear lots of docs saying, I can't even break even on most of the clinical trials.
I think you're right. I think we're at a watershed moment in research as other aspects of oncology treatment right now in the community because of changes in reimbursement. So what we're seeing is a dichotomy. We're seeing some practices saying, it's just not worth it for me to stay in research because I have all that overhead of the regulatory and the data managers and so forth. And that may not be an expertise, by the way. So they're saying it's just not worth doing it. Other practices, I think, are tending to link up. So my personal feeling is you're going to see networks become more and more important. And there's 4 or 5 networks out there, including ACORN, that have grown over the last few years. And I think that will probably be the future because I think it's going to be very difficult for individual practices to either support themselves from a revenue model and even to get to attract the best protocols going forward in the future. Now, the problem, there's really 2 types of trials that are available. As you mentioned, one are pharmaceutical-based research and the other is NCI-based research. I ran a CCOP for 5 years, and so I'm very familiar with the NCI mechanism. I'm very concerned about the fact that the funding for a patient now in an NCI-sponsored trial through CCOP or even doing it individually is only $2,000 through the CTSU, and it's only $2,000 per patient with a requirement now to follow patients longer and longer. I simply don't believe that community practices are going to be able to make that investment because whatever margins used to be there from purchasing drugs that used to fund endeavors like this and other things that practices do, like provide nutritional support and provide bereavement counseling and all the other things that aren't ever paid for, research is going to take a hit here. And particularly in the community, NCI research will take a hit. And there's no prospects that I'm aware of to increase that per patient grant right now. So what we're seeing is cooperative groups like SWOG literally closing committees, whole disease committees, because there's not enough interest, or there's interest, but there's not enough patient support to make that work. Now, pharma companies have stepped up to the plate, and I've seen, even over my career over the last 10 years, a big change in sponsors going to the community now for protocols that used to run through CTEP or through cooperative groups. And I think that's a good thing. In breast cancer, this is still a big issue because there aren't pharma-sponsored studies in the adjuvant setting, which is where we've traditionally accrued the most patients. And I think it's certainly reasonable to continue to accrue patients to adjuvant trials through NCI sponsorship, and I applaud those and support those programs, but they're going to be increasingly difficult to do because they're underfunded. They don't even come close to paying for the cost of the trial. You asked before, how does research stack up? Now, research will never be a huge revenue generator. It should never be, because then that introduces a bias for putting patients on study. I would argue that by the same token, it shouldn't be a drain on the practice because there's already enough barriers against research in a busy practice. And if you're literally having to pay for the privilege of doing research, it's just not going to wash in the current environment, particularly for most practices that are seeing a lot of patients and are not focused only on doing research.
So what kind of pay is available for the pharma-sponsored trials?
It can vary dramatically. It could be as little as $3,000 or $4,000. It could be as much as $10,000 to $15,000. What's key there, and one of the things that ACORN has helped practices and certainly helped me understand, not as a businessman, but just a rudimentary understanding, is it's not the total value of the grant. It's what they're paying for. So, for example, if you're following a patient for 2 years in a study and you have to get a CT scan every 3 months and that's not the standard of care, then that grant will pay for CTs that are beyond the standard of care. One of the things we've done in ACORN is strip out every protocol and develop a line item of what standard of care for every assessment throughout the entire life of the study, what standard of care and what is research. We never double bill, so patients only get billed for those things that are standard of care. Anything that is research related, of course, is reimbursed directly through the grant.
So what are the trials right now that ACORN is running?
We have approximately 60 studies open with about 40 different sponsors. We have trials open with all of the major pharmaceutical companies, a number of small biotechs as well. And that includes some of the common studies that you hear about, the Ribbon trials, for example, with Genentech. We've done the lapatinib trials with GSK. We've done satraplatin trials with GPC, so forth. And many both investigational agents and drugs that are already marketed. I think last year throughout ACORN, we had 30 investigational agents that were part of our portfolio, and that was a broad range, ranging from immunotherapy to TKIs to novel compounds to cytotoxics. The other thing that is important in ACORN is what we call the niche of ACORN-initiated trials, which allows our investigators, many of whom are key community-based thought leaders, the opportunity to write trials. And that's very difficult if you're in practice because you have no protected time. Even if you have some expertise in writing a protocol, it's almost impossible to get it done. So what ACORN does, because we have full-time scientific staff that includes PhD-level statisticians and medical writers, we're able to take an idea that one of our physicians has, develop a letter of intent, submit it to the pharmaceutical company to see if they're interested in funding it. If they are, we can then write a complete protocol and then run that. So we've actually run now, we have about 10 ACORN-initiated trials that are up and running. They essentially are investigator-initiated trials, but they're much more robust because they're multi-center trials and they have a rigorous statistical plan and publication plan. We've completed up to 150 patient phase 2 studies. We're doing a couple of large randomized phase 2 studies that run into the 200 to 300 patient range now that we have run. We'll hold the IND for an investigational drug as well.
So what are you doing in breast cancer specifically?
So in breast cancer, we just completed a study of nab-paclitaxel and capecitabine, which was a phase 2 study, which we reported at both San Antonio and at ASCO this year. That's completed. We have a data lock, and we're writing that up now for publication.
What do we know about the results so far?
The results were very favorable. The response rate was the primary endpoint, and we saw a 52% response rate in that group of patients with very good tolerability. Patients were eligible actually to continue monotherapy with one or the other drug beyond the 6 months of therapy, and many patients, there actually are a few patients who remained on study even up to 12 months after initiation of therapy.
Now, to what extent has this combination been looked at previously?
I'm not aware that this combination has been looked at. See, weekly nab-paclitaxel has been looked at as a single agent through U.S. Oncology, has done a number of trials. We picked a dose of 125 milligrams day 1-8 with capecitabine day 1 through 14 on a 21-day schedule, which was intermediate between other weekly doses that have been used for nab-paclitaxel.
You know, it's interesting because first you had the docetaxel capecitabine data that came out, Joyce's Sonacy, et cetera, and sort of excitement, but people were concerned about the toxicity. But then there were a couple studies, one by Bill Gratishar, the other Julian Blum, looking at paclitaxel and capecitabine. And that, to me, looked very encouraging, although people didn't seem to pick up on it that much. But it seemed a lot less toxic and pretty similar in efficacy, pretty efficacious. So to me, what you looked at, which is NAB plus capecitabine, makes a lot of sense.
There's been a great debate over the last few years in breast cancer. I think we spent a lot of energy, in my opinion, undue energy, debating singlet versus doublet therapy. I think we've moved past that now since we're in the targeted therapy era. But I think that debate was a cul-de-sac for us because, as you point out, it doesn't matter if it's a singlet or doublet. What really matters is what's the toxicity.
Right.
And if the program is called drug A versus drug B, and drug B has same toxicity as drug A and doubles the progression-free survival, you'd pick drug B every time. If drug B happens to be two agents, what difference does it make, in my opinion? So I'm still a believer that doublet therapy is reasonable in a subset of patients, and those who have visceral disease, who have rapidly progressive disease, where you do want the best response as soon as possible. That's not every patient with metastatic breast cancer, but there certainly are patients that come in every day to my clinic who I think can benefit from the most effective therapy as even defined by response rate.
I'm curious what your algorithm is, metastatic disease, in a situation where you're going to be getting chemotherapy, either the patient, and let's talk about HER2 negative situation, either a patient who's triple negative or a patient who's already had hormones and now is hormone unresponsive. How do you think through selection of agents, whether it's single or double, and then bringing in bevacizumab? Again, in a non-protocol setting.
To some extent, it depends on what the prior adjuvant therapy has been. So in a triple negative patient, and I should mention parenthetically that seeing stage 4 patients at presentation in my community is not an uncommon sequence at all. So we see, unfortunately, a number of advanced breast cancer patients, including advanced stage 3 and even stage 4 patients. Perhaps we're picking up more because we're doing more staging on some of the patients that look like they have locally advanced disease and, in fact, have metastatic disease. But in any event, if the patient has triple negative breast cancer and has visceral disease and or is symptomatic, I'm impressed by E2100 and I would use a taxane plus bevacizumab. Because in my practice, the adjuvant treatment of choice to date has been dose-dense AC paclitaxel. If a patient has relapsed within some arbitrary number, let's say 24 months, I will probably use docetaxel and bevacizumab off protocol. Though I should mention that we're currently running a large phase 2, which is looking at docetaxel and bevacizumab plus or minus trastuzumab for HER2-positive patients. And so that study would be my first-line approach to a triple-negative patient.
Plus or minus trastuzumab?
Well, plus or minus, what I mean is plus trastuzumab if they're HER2-positive.
Right, I see. Right. Okay. What about the issue of using a combination, whether it's paclitaxel or nab-paclitaxel, with capecitabine, for example, and bevacizumab?
I think that's a very interesting question. We saw some data from Edith Perez on that, and it did have some increased toxicity with the combination of docetaxel and capecitabine. We're considering taking our nab-paclitaxel and capecitabine program and adding bevacizumab to it because it seemed to be very well tolerated as our next phase 2 study.
What other studies are you doing right now in ACORN for breast cancer?
We have just launched studies with other TKIs, particularly with both sunitinib and sorafenib. So there is a breast cancer development program with each of those. We're very interested in those drugs because of being multi-targeted kinases, not only hit VEGF, but sometimes other targets as well, particularly with sorafenib. So we're doing a number of studies with sorafenib. First-line study, which is interesting, that Bill Gratishar is the PI on, which is looking at, it's actually modeling E2100 identically. So it's paclitaxel at 90 milligrams per meter squared, days 1, 8, 15, exactly in E2100, and substituting for the bevacizumab, randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled sorafenib versus placebo. And that study has launched. That study, of course, for patients who are felt to be bevacizumab candidates by their physicians wouldn't necessarily go on that. But I think the jury is still out for some physicians. So that's been launched both in ACORN and as part of our CRO capabilities. We've been doing that outside the ACORN network as well. Another interesting trial is one that Cliff Huddis is PI on, which is looking at second-line therapy after bevacizumab failure. using sorafenib. So those patients who have been treated with bevacizumab plus chemotherapy in the first line and have either relapsed or refractory are then randomized to receive gemcitabine plus sorafenib or placebo.
What do we know about sorafenib, or for that matter, sunitinib in breast cancer?
Both of them have been looked at in relatively small data sets, in phase 1 and 2 data sets. And if you look across single-agent activity with bevacizumab, sunitinib, or sorafenib, they all fall into the 6-month progression-free survival in second- or third-line patients in the 20% range. So, of course, as single agents, no one believes that these drugs will be useful as single agents, but coupled with chemotherapy, they all appear to have potentially similar degrees of efficacy.
Not to get too far out on a tangent, I'm curious what your thoughts were about the presentation at ASCO looking at sorafenib in hepatocellular carcinoma, and particularly the fact that they saw such positive results in a phase 3 trial where the phase 2 data wasn't that impressive, and what the implications might be for studying biologic agents in terms of trial design.
Well, that was one of the rare cases where the phase 3 study actually did better than the phase 2 study. It's often the other way around,
right,
as you know. In fact, actually, the literature is replete with studies that jump right from phase 1 to phase 3 and then are negative. So I don't know. That may be a statistical aberration. I think the target was well planned in hepatocellular carcinoma, so there was good preclinical and phase 1 and 2 data that suggested that this would be a good target. And so it actually bore out the biology, I believe, pretty well.
One of the studies you're doing in ACORN that I thought was interesting is combining fulvestrant and capecitabine. Can you talk a little bit about that trial? I like both of those drugs. I was curious that you put them together.
Yeah, we're just launching that, and it's actually a study that's been gestating for some time. I actually thought about doing this about 18 months or so. And when I went back and I looked at the literature on combining chemotherapy and hormonal therapy, I found that, first of all, there hasn't been any work done on that in a clinical level for at least 20 years. And the work that was done previously was with tamoxifen, so a less effective hormonal therapy, if you will, and often CMF or CMF-like therapy. And the study design, of course, 20, 25 years ago was very different than they would be today. I would actually say that although there were some signals with that regimen and that combination that there might be some antagonism, I think that if you look at the data carefully, there's certainly room for a different interpretation and that it's worth exploring again. So the question is, why should we explore it today in an era where we have all this targeted therapies? And I think there's a few reasons for that. Number one, first of all, today most patients are started on an aromatase inhibitor in the adjuvant setting if they're hormone receptor positive. We actually have very little data about how well patients do failing an AI and what their progression-free survival is once they have failed an AI in the adjuvant setting. If you extrapolate, and if you look at some data, including Bill Gradishaw's data there, actually the time to progression is very short once you've failed an AI. In fact, actually 50% of patients have failed by 4 months. So what are you actually accomplishing? Our paradigm for decades now has been, of course, start a patient on a hormonal agent because you want to buy as much time before you start chemotherapy. Well, if half the patients are only getting 4 months, we're not really benefiting the majority of the patients. And even the progression-free survival with a single agent may not be very high. Fulvestrant by itself perhaps is a little bit more effective, but we don't anticipate that because these patients will be at least somewhat hormone resistant to an AI, that the downregulation of the receptor may help somewhat, and perhaps in certain groups of patients, perhaps in HER2-positive patients and so forth, but we don't know that. So the question is there a room for chemotherapy with hormonal therapy? And again, it harkens back to the same argument, why would you want to start a doublet versus a singlet? And I think it comes to a toxicity issue. If you can give a drug that is very well tolerated, doesn't have a lot of toxicity, and prolongs the time till patient receives IV chemotherapy, then I think there might be some benefit there.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. There's all this debate about combination versus single agent therapy. You know, the docetaxel capecitabine combination that I mentioned generated a lot of that. But then when we had paclitaxel and bevacizumab, granted bevacizumab wasn't chemotherapy, people just didn't really think twice about it because bevacizumab, just like you say, really wasn't adding any toxicity.
Right, exactly. So it's partly how you spin it, and it's partly the politics, and it's the zeitgeist of the moment and what the drug is. So there's a lot more to it. I think, frankly, one of the things that fascinates me about being in oncology for 20 years is that it's always more than the science. It's fads come and go. I've seen many so-called breakthrough cures come and go and come back and so forth. It's very interesting to follow the long term. Just to finish up on that, the capecitabine dosing is novel in this particular program because it's metronomic in the sense it's fixed dose, fixed, relatively low dose, 1,500 milligrams per day, continuous, along with the fulvestrant. And I'm encouraged, although the study was designed before we saw the data that came out from Excalibur, the fact that capecitabine, at least in combination with bevacizumab, seemed to benefit ER-positive patients much more than ER-negative patients, I think now post hoc lends perhaps even more credibility to this approach.
So what you're talking about is the fact that there seemed to be greater benefit or benefit with the ER-positive with capecitabine, bevacizumab.
Correct. One way to look at that is if you discount that bevacizumab was doing much at all, perhaps it was just a capecitabine effect. We don't know that, but certainly there was no negative signal for patients with the capecitabine in ER-positive patients.
How are you utilizing capecitabine right now in clinical practice? I think all the BEV data has made that very confusing, and particularly the recent Excalibur data that George Sledge presented at ASCO.
It's interesting that over the years, capecitabine has become an increasingly more important drug in the treatment of metastatic breast cancer, where it used to be used in the third-line setting or be used as a salvage therapy after patients have received all other IV chemotherapies. It's certainly in my practice and most of the people that I speak with around the country has moved up to first or second line in many individuals. It's easy to give. The responses when you see the responses are often gratifyingly long. And I think now the bevacizumab data certainly gives us some pause. So for patients that are eligible for bevacizumab, we still have some work to do. For patients that are not eligible for one reason or another, certainly I think capecitabine is an excellent drug to use. And again, it's a good platform to even build combinations on.
And the other part of this, the fulvestrant, I'm also curious about your take on that and also what your thoughts are in terms of the issue of loading dose.
Yes. In this protocol, we have moved to the loading dose strategy, which is 500 milligrams on day 1, 250 milligrams on day 15, 250 milligrams on day 29, and then monthly 250 milligrams. And that's based on pharmacokinetic data that shows that if you use the label dose, which is 250 every 28 days, it actually takes several months to get up to steady state levels. So you may not actually be achieving target concentrations of the drug for 3 or 4 months, and many patients may have progressed by that time. So that has become the standard in this protocol, and in fact, in my practice off study as well.
Any problems in terms of reimbursement or getting it paid for?
Haven't had any problem with that.